Hey, how's it going, everybody? It's the Peter Principal, but I'm Scott Horton filling in. He's off for the night, off doing who knows what. If you don't know me, I'm Scott Horton, and I do the weekend interview show Saturdays from 3 to 5 Texas time here on the Republic Broadcasting Network all over America and who knows where else. So if you like what you hear, then check out my show every Saturday from 3 to 5. And my website, if you want to hear the archives of any of the great interviews I've done in the past, is weekendinterviewshow.com. And on tomorrow's show, I will be interviewing Gordon Prather, who is a nuclear expert and is the most informed source that I know of to educate me and you guys in the audience about our growing conflict with the nation state of Iran. And so we'll be talking with Gordon Prather all about that tomorrow at, I believe, 3, maybe 4, but I think 3 o'clock tomorrow here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You can always listen at RBN Live if the FM is not blaring in your neighborhood. But for right now, I want to introduce tonight's guest. His name is Matt Barganier, although I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. And he's the editor of antiwar.com. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
It's great to talk to you, sir. I'm doing great. Let's see here. I was talking to a buddy of mine last week, Matt, and I said, man, don't you ever read antiwar.com? And he said, those guys are lefties. And I said, no, wait, no, they're not, no, they're not. So give us the spiel, Matt. I know you hear this all the time. The website is called antiwar.com, and people immediately think of white kids with dreadlocks sitting blocking traffic in the middle of the street, and they don't want to hear it after that. So what's the deal with you guys anyway?
Well, we get a lot of the left-wing extremist stuff, people accusing us of being that. We also get the right-wing extremist stuff. Those don't really bother me too much either way because, as I see it, those terms are outmoded. They don't really make much sense when applied to us. I suppose that I feel probably more accustomed to being called a right-winger because I'm opposed to, for instance, income tax, Social Security, things like that, which would make me a very strange left-winger indeed.
Right.
But you know, those terms just don't. We run people left, right, center, mainstream, and outside of the mainstream. So, you know, I don't think that it makes much sense to call us any of those things. We're libertarians, which in traditional terminology puts us more to the right, I suppose. But you know, I don't worry about it too much, no matter what they call me.
Right. Well, and as far as the regular columnists that line the right side of the page there, you guys are all libertarians there, whether there's links to left-wing or right-wing columns somewhere in the substance of the page. At least the regular writers for anti-war are all libertarians, right?
Right. And in terms of regular contributors, not, you know, not the columnists, but people whose work that we run pretty often, most of those are libertarians, are conservatives even, so.
Yeah, there you go. Pat Buchanan's at the top of the list of additional contributors there. All right, everybody, it's the Peter Principal. I'm Scott Horton, and we're talking with Matt Barganier from antiwar.com. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Principal. I'm Scott Horton, filling in for Peter, who's off tonight. And I'm the host of the weekend interview show every Saturday here on the Republic Broadcasting Network from 3 to 5 p.m. Texas time. And that's tomorrow from 3 to 5. And Gordon Prather will be on the show tomorrow. It should be a really good show. He's a great guy, so definitely tune into that. And right now I'm talking to Matt Barganier. He's the editor of antiwar.com. And funny thing happened to me a couple of weeks ago, Matt. For the first time, someone who I have great respect for and actually have known for a long, long time, someone who I couldn't just, you know, kind of go, oh, yeah, right, whatever, but someone who I had to, you know, really consider this guy's opinion as, you know, he's not a mean-spirited kind of guy at all. You know, he's a good guy. He really does believe in liberty. And he told me that he supports the war in Iraq because he thinks that 25 years from now, the Middle East is going to be an entirely different place, and it's going to be modern, and it's going to be democratic, and it's going to be capitalistic, and it's going to be great, and that it's tough work, and yeah, it takes a lot of a bloody mess to get it done, but that in the end, world history will prove that it was the right thing to do for the West to go into the Middle East and modernize them with force. And so I wonder if it's somebody who you can't just go, oh, please, you're an idiot. If it's somebody who you actually have to, you know, address with respect in that argument, what do you say to somebody who says something like that to you, Matt?
Well, I think someone like that generally has his or her heart in the right place. And in terms of what they hope the Middle East will look like in 25 years, I think that very few people could hope that it would look otherwise. The problem is the means, and the means in two different ways. One is moral, whether it is morally justifiable to try to modernize or westernize or liberalize other countries through the use of force. The fact of the matter is that many people are, in fact, content to not be westernized or liberalized or modernized at this time. Now, of course, even in these countries, there may be a minority who are, but liberalizing countries at gunpoint is a moral problem for libertarians. The second one is practical, whether using force is likely to actually produce the desired outcomes, or whether it's going to incite more opposition from the fundamentalist or extremist in these places to what might otherwise be a sort of natural progression toward a more liberal order. And those are the two things that libertarians and conservatives and liberals, anyone I think who is, you know, has generally benign hopes for the rest of the world, any of us would have to consider.
Well, on the moral question, I think their answer to that would probably be to say, bring up, in fact, I think Condoleezza Rice made this example or this analogy to the civil rights movement, and that, you know, you're right, the majority of people over there are oppressing the minority of people over there. And just because they're a minority of people who want to be westernized and liberalized, they deserve to be, and somebody's got to help them, or else they're just going to be, subjects of some petty despot their whole life. And that that intervention is necessary to even if it's not a majority of people who want it.
Well, okay, again, that would get to the moral question of how are we going to separate these people that we deem the good guys from the bad guys when we're dropping bombs over there, and of course that's not possible. In the second place, how is it that this intervention on behalf of a minority is going to actually help that minority? Isn't it actually just going to anger the majority? In the third place, and this is what I should have really, I also should have included this on the practical side in my first response, what are the results going to be for the United States? The U.S. government has, if any purpose whatsoever, if any legitimate purpose, the defense of American citizens. And if it is not acting in ways that promote that defense, that are, you know, either just a waste of taxpayer money or, in fact, are counterproductive, then the U.S. government is not living up to its responsibility to its citizenry. Never mind what it may accomplish overseas, which, you know, is highly dubious that it would accomplish very much.
So it's a case where the hardliners on either side are really just kind of playing off each other, and the more terrorism we create over there, the better it is for the hardliners over here, the better it is for the hardliners over there.
Yes, I think that that's definitely the case, and that appears to be the case, particularly in Iran. There have been some interesting pieces on Iran lately, and Americans or American pundits tend to project American situations or conditions onto foreign countries. which is something that I think we'll probably get into more as we discuss more recent events, particularly things in Ukraine. But so we hear about these reformers in Iran, and they are real. There really is a core of liberal, at least in relative terms, reformers in Iran.
And they have a very young population, too.
Right, right. And, but so this really exists to a much greater extent than it exists or existed in Iraq previous before the war. And but the reality is that even the reformers, even the liberals in Iran are intensely nationalistic. They may like Western cultural products or Western intellectual concepts of government, but they do not want to be told what to do by outside powers. They're just as nationalistic as the hardliners in whom they find an opposition domestically.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, we can't stand it for the French to even so much as suggest a different policy than the one we're going about. How would we feel if Iran talked to us the way we talk to Iran? You got to wonder.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I remember there being some a big brouhaha right before our election about The Guardian, a left-wing British newspaper, starting a letter-writing campaign from British citizens to American voters in Ohio, I believe, trying to convince them to vote for Kerry. And there was a huge backlash against this, particularly on, the usual suspects, Limbaugh and Fox News and such. And to some extent, I can understand that. I thought that the jingoism that accompanied it was a little bit stupid, but the basic instinct there that British citizens who don't really know what American voters are voting about, why should we pay that much attention to them? And you can imagine amplifying that to, you know, an occupying army telling the local populace what to think, what to do, how they're going to organize their government and even their society.
In fact, we at one time had an occupying army from Great Britain on these shores, and we did something about that, if I remember my history right.
Correct, and that of course, a lot of things about the American Revolution, it was frequently cited, as I recall, in the responses to these letter writers from, inspired by The Guardian. So, yeah, and even the president himself a couple of months ago, I can't remember exactly the context, said something about, people don't like to be occupied. Heck, even the Iraqis probably don't like being occupied. This is not something that you have to be even anti-war to understand. It just seems that any moderately intelligent human being understands it.
Particularly when we're talking about airstrikes here, the country's been occupied for almost 2 years, I guess, a year and two-thirds or so here, and we're still dropping bombs from the air. And I think anybody can understand that, laser-guided or not, or satellite-guided or not, that innocent people are being killed. And, hell, for that matter, the guilty people are being killed, and all these people are leaving behind family members. And, it shouldn't be that hard to imagine, I don't think, walk a mile in another man's shoes kind of thing. What do you do if they drop a bomb and it blows up your brother? Do you not go and join the resistance? I mean, any human on earth would react in the same way, I think, no?
I believe so. I think that there's a profound lack of empathy, which is unfortunate, even if for purely strategic reasons. We're not talking even bleeding heart or moral reasons. It used to be a standard principle of warfare or diplomacy that you try to understand, you try to empathize with your enemy, you try to look through their eyes and see things the way that they see them.
I think, is it maybe possible the reason we're not doing that this time is because we're not really, our government and media don't really want us asking that question too closely because we might find that they're more in the right than we are?
Oh, I'm sure that that's true, but it also appears that, you know, I think that that was, that's been the case in various other American conflicts, such as Vietnam. But I do think that once the government and the government-controlled media will ignore these things and will not present these issues or this way of seeing things to the public, but once they forego that sort of empathy on their own, then they're making poor strategic decisions based upon it.
Very good point. We end up doing, like just what you said about Iran, transferring our point of view onto theirs. All right, we'll be right back with Matt Barganier. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Peter Principle. I'm Scott Horton, filling in for him tonight. He is off, and I am the host of the Weekend Interview Show every Saturday from 3 to 5 Texas time, so please tune in to that. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com if you want to hear the archives of any of the previous interviews. And my guest right now on the Peter Shanks Show is Matt Barganier. He's the editor of antiwar.com, which is, honestly, now that I'm kind of running my own business and working 14 and 16-hour days every day, I really don't get a chance to do too much reading, but every single day I check antiwar.com. They've got, I don't know, 300-something of the most important headlines, particularly regarding foreign policy, up every day, and good columns, and their regular writers, particularly Justin Raimondo and Matt himself, are just great. And, in fact, speaking of that, Matt, you need to write more often. You're good on the blog, man, but I really miss the collateral damage column.
Yeah, well, I sometimes have a hard time coming up with something original to say on things, and I usually try to reserve it for when I have something really original to say. But
I'll always remember,
you.
Mr. Sharon, tear down those empty mobile homes. I love that one. That's great. Okay, so before the break, Matt, we were talking about empathy, and not just, you know, from a moral boo-hoo point of view, but in wartime, practical empathy, putting yourself in your opponent's shoes or your enemy's shoes to figure out, you know, never mind him, but how best to protect yourself. And this is something that, as you were saying, this is something that we really haven't done in the war against Al-Qaeda. We basically say, well, they hate us for our freedom, and we kind of leave it at that, and they kind of let us hang with the impression that this is all unprovoked terrorism against us. And I was just going to bring up that when I was trying to have a little empathy and see things from my enemy's point of view, two very important things came into view. And one of them, the most important thing that happened was I read a book called A Pretext for War by James Bamford. And I subsequently interviewed James Bamford on this show, or on my Saturday show. And the most important part of what he said was that September 11th was a trick. It wasn't that they, you know, thought that we would just turn tail and run home, and that they made a tactical mistake, like it seemed to a lot of people, but that, in fact, September 11th was, like the analogy is like slapping you right in front of your girlfriend to force you to fight, and that they were trying to trick us into coming running across the ocean as fast as we could and spending millions and billions and billions of dollars occupying the land and getting bogged down in their sand trap, that it was a deliberate provocation to trick us into what I guess Bin Laden called in his video Operation Bleed America Dry or something like that. And boy, you know, that sure takes the war on terrorism and puts it in a whole different light when you think of our response to September 11th as exactly what Osama bin Laden was hoping for.
Well, right. And it's interesting that many of the American proponents of the war spoke of this flypaper theory, which was that we were going to, which in and of itself was just incredibly callous, never mind toward Iraqis, but toward, you know, American soldiers, that you're going to send American soldiers into a place to just be these sorts of targets that would pull in the flies, I suppose, to the flypaper. But this is really strange. This is akin to sticking your arm into a beehive and then saying, aha, I drew them all onto it. This was an odd, it seems that the flypaper was actually reversed in any meaningful sense. That they set out the flypaper and we have been drawn to it.
Absolutely. I mean, after all, they can't shoot at us when we're safe back here in North America, but we send all our young kids out to their neighborhood and they're within rifle range now.
Correct. And things are so much worse. We hear all of this about how the liberal media just won't get out the good news. They just won't get out the good news. What is the good news exactly when U.S. officials cannot even go to the Baghdad airport? Is that the good news?
They can't even walk around the green zone without getting bombed.
It's the real news, even that which is supposed to be good news. I had a piece on our blog last night, antiwar.com/blog, about this letter that's circulating from an official in the green zone there, a U.S. official who is in charge of getting water to the entire country of Iraq. This is amazing if you read the letter, because this person, and I don't mean to impugn the character or motives of this person at all. I'm sure that she's a perfectly good person with good motives and all of that, but sounds as if she can't be more than, you know, a semester out of college and does not have any technical expertise in the field that she is in charge of. But anyway, there's some interesting just little slice of life things there where she talks about how you can't even walk around in the green zone without a flak jacket.
The green zone being one of Saddam's former palaces where the American authority is now stationed.
Right, and how if every single, you know, missile or bomb that went off in or in the vicinity of the green zone, if you paid attention to that, you'd never get any work done. Now, this is the good news.
Yeah, everything's going great. All right, everybody, it's the Peter Principle. I'm Scott Horton filling in for Peter Shank. He's off tonight. My guest is Matt Barganier. He's the editor of antiwar.com. And we'll be right back after these short messages.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Hey there, how's it going, everybody? You're listening to the Peter Principle on the Republic Broadcasting Network, but I'm not him. I'm Scott Horton, the host of the weekend interview show, and I'm filling in for Peter, who's out tonight. Should be back Monday, I think. So, anyways, I'm talking with Matt Barganier. He's the editor of antiwar.com, which is a great libertarian news site, especially for those of us who are most concerned with foreign policy. And, you know, I was reading the headlines today. It says there's more troops on their way to Iraq. They decided that, turns out, according to TV, that, okay, there really are some problems with the occupation of Iraq. It's really not going that smooth. And so we're going to solve that problem by finally listening to the skeptics who said all along what we need is more soldiers on the ground. And so now that's what we're going to do. And supposedly that's going to solve everything in time to hold elections on January the 30th. What do you say, Matt? You think the election's going to happen on time, or you think they're going to have to postpone it again?
Well, I think it's going to have to go forward at this point with, you know, Alawi and Yawar and Bush having all said that it has to go forward. I don't see how they can back off that now. I have no idea what will happen, although I'm sure that it will not be what we were promised. But, yeah, so they're sending 12,000 more, or they're boosting American troop levels by 12,000. And, again, there's no end in sight. This essentially means, as one retired general recently said, that this is the re-Americanization of the effort, meaning that it's the Iraqification project is done for the time being. they're not trying to hand this over. They've given up, at least for the time being, on trying to hand this over to indigenous forces, and they're going to up U.S. troop levels. Although they will still be at 150,000, they'll still be at half of what General Shinseki said before the invasion, which, of course, the reason they didn't want to listen to that was not because they didn't want a long-term commitment. The reason they didn't want to listen to that is because it was effectively an anti-war point. If you were saying that you were going to send 300,000 U.S. troops there, that was essentially a no-go. They couldn't have gotten away with that. That's the reason that they went in there with a smaller force, because they were just trying to be fast about it and get out as quickly as possible.
Well, and not only that, perhaps going in with too light of an amount of force is a way to guarantee a long-term commitment. That, you know, I'm reminded of Jay Garner saying, hey, let's hold elections. And they say, hey, you're fired, pal. And really, they want to stay. They don't want a quick solution to this, man.
I don't think that they want a quick solution to it either, but I don't know that that necessarily means that they will postpone the vote. From all indications that I've seen, they want to have the vote. After that, or, you know, I'm sure that they already have their preset justification for why we'll have to stay after that, no matter what the outcome is. But it does appear to me that the vote will go ahead on January 30th.
Well, it's looking like there could be a lot of trouble with the Sunnis, who mostly, from what I've read, a lot of the Sunni imams are urging all their followers to boycott the election. They're not recognizing it as valid at all. So, you know, if only Shia turn out to vote and they all elect al-Sistani's guys, then you're going to have some really upset Sunnis and probably some Kurds, too. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying it's not going to be a fiasco. It will be. But I really don't see any way that they can back out of it. Yet, of course, they've surprised me so many times before that I can't say I would be shocked if it were postponed, even if it were postponed at the last minute.
You know, what's funny is, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but if I remember correctly, what they had been saying was the election's going to happen on January 1st. And then they moved it back to January 30th, but they didn't even call it moving it back. They just kind of pretended like it was always January 30th.
Right. Well, you know, the dates don't matter, I don't suppose, if you're going to be there forever.
Right, yeah.
Maybe they'll just postpone it to February 28th.
Yeah, there you go. And then, you know, April 19th after that, probably.
Right, I mean, I guess it's democracy so long as there's always an election pending.
Yeah, right. That's funny. And then, you know, of course, the majority should get their way once the democracy rules. It should be great.
Oh, right. And, well, it's interesting that we're going to either learn something about majoritarianism after this election or about authoritarianism. Either way, we're going to find out something about the reality of democracy itself or U.S. unwillingness, perhaps somewhat prudently, I would have to say, to go along with democracy in Iraq.
Right, because then we're just going to have to deal with the Grand Ayatollah again.
Right.
Wow, yeah, being an empire is really difficult, man.
It
seems like
it
all these things
way.
To manage and plan. Doesn't seem like, I don't know, I wonder if our chief executive is up to the task of all this planning that needs to be done.
Well, I'm not too worried about it. With the super competent staff that he has at his side, I mean, there's no reason to worry, really.
Yeah, well, and speaking of, well, let's see, I could take this two different ways. I could go with the extreme quality of his staff, and we could talk about neocons and shifts in the cabinet, or we could stick with the majoritarian democracy thing and talk about Ukraine, Matt. What do you say? Pick your poison.
We should probably talk about Ukraine because in many ways it shows more of the pure imperialism rather than just this, you know, so long as the U.S. is conducting wars in the Middle East or funding regimes in the Middle East, it may look like some sort of exceptional case where the U.S. has to intervene for some specific reason. And that's what we're often told, that this is an imperialism, that this is because of all the factors that are unique to the Middle East. Well, with Ukraine, we see that really it's pretty much the same thing everywhere. interference, intervention, manipulation, belligerence, and it doesn't really change that much from region to region.
Well, what does America have at stake in the Ukraine? That's pretty far from, you know, even Western Europe.
Absolutely nothing, if by America you mean American citizens.
Which, of course, is what I meant, but I guess that's really not what to take into consideration.
Right.
That's not really the point, is it?
Right. The U.S. has absolutely nothing at stake that I can see, or the U.S., again, being the aggregate of individual Americans. A lot of people have a certain bone to pick. You know, a lot of people, however sincerely, want to push the democracy thing everywhere. And I think that they're misguided. But, okay, so that's part of it. And so they see these demonstrations in the street, and they're willing to accept everything at face value, what they see on the evening news. And, okay, so this is the great push forward for democracy. A lot of other people are using this as a sort of proxy battle, a proxy Cold War, really, with Russia. And now, what value the average U.S. citizen is supposed to get out of either a cold or a hot war with Russia is beyond me.
Are we talking about pipeline paths here? Because, you know, I'm picturing kind of the North Caucasus region, and I know that a lot of the neoconservatives kind of try to pick a fight with Russia over Chechnya as well. And, you know, I mean, they still have thousands of nuclear missiles and stuff like that, so I don't think we want to push them that hard, do we? But are we? I guess we are. Are we?
I think in every case, in the Middle East, you know, it's not completely about Israel, and it's not completely about oil, and it's not completely about American hegemony or national greatness. There are these confluence of factors. I think in any one particular case, we can say that one outweighs others. For instance, in the Middle East, I do think that the predominant factor is security of Israel. In this case, I think part of it is just the neoconservatives being ideologically consistent. It would be inconsistent of them not to want to meddle in Ukraine. You know, it would be inconsistent of them not to want to meddle anywhere. Samoa, for instance. So I think that partly they are just being true to themselves on this. The other problem, though, the places like Russia or China, the threat that they pose is some sort of counterweight to U.S. power abroad. And that is what cannot be tolerated.
So any idea of, like, Russia and China, maybe even in Europe, kind of joining as an economic force against us, that has to be fought at all costs?
Yeah, and you notice how quickly these things shift back and forth. We've been hearing about how the EU is just this terrible monster. And, of course, as a libertarian, I have all sorts of problems with the EU. But just in a larger sense, if we look over the past couple of years, we heard all of these things about how horrible the EU and the main powers in it, such as Germany and France, are, that they were, because they pose some sort of at least tiny impediment to war against Iraq. But now, of course, they're perfectly great. And if, you know, there are people in Ukraine who aren't so keen on bowing to the EU's every demand, then that just shows how uncivilized those elements are and how they have to be marginalized and defeated.
Right.
So really all of these things, it is just amazing. Somebody really does need to start taking a record of everything that the internationalists, not just the neoconservatives, but predominantly them, but the internationalists, the interventionists, keep a record of what they say about country X or group Y or person Z, and then see what they say about them, you know, 6 months from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now.
Yeah, I think probably the most dangerous thing in the world is to be one of their puppets, because it's not too long before you find a knife in the back. Like Suharto in Indonesia back in 97.
Right.
Boy, here he'd been a loyal dictator of ours for 30-something years, right? And we just said, all right, out you go. Next.
Right, right. And there was a certain, you know, this has always been true. And, of course, In that case, we have sort of the realist school of American foreign policy thought backtracking upon itself. But, of course, that's perfectly logical for them. They pretty much are willing to say, okay, we're totally amoral in terms of our projection of power, which is something that used to be of great concern to me, and thought that there couldn't really be anything worse than that until the crop that we have now, which is making the realists look better all the time. But so, of course, you know, they could say, okay, well, we'll use somebody like Suharto as long as they're useful to us in their generally misguided notion of the national interest. But again, it looks far less misguided than what we have now.
God save us from the morality-based foreign policy.
Right. Well, that's what's particularly galling is that, you know, they go about, you know, just seething with rage toward anyone who stands in the way of their democratization of the entire planet. But, of course, you know, these people are just as expendable to them as Suharto was to the realists.
Great. So, hey, you know what? I forgot to give out the phone number. If anybody wants to call in and get on the air, Matt Bargainier, the editor of antiwar.com, is the guest. I'm Scott Horton, by the way. And anyway, the phone number is 1-800-313-9443, 1-800-313-9443, if anybody wants to call and get involved in the conversation. And, yeah, you know, this Ukraine thing is very interesting to watch because you have, like you were saying, the forces of progressivism and European brotherliness and all this kind of thing taking the side of, I forget how to pronounce their names, but the challenger, who's who's the more Western character. And, you know, apparently, from what I've heard, there are, you know, reports of substantial voter fraud on the part of the incumbent. But it just brings up the question of, you know, why exactly is it our business again? You know, whether this guy is stealing the election or not.
Well, right. And of course, you know, I have pointed to something on our blog, I think sometime last year. I forget what it was in reference to. But shortly after the 2000 election, The Onion, the satirical newspaper, had some article about, you know, this was in the wake of you know, all the cries of fraud and judicial intervention in the 2000 U.S. election. Something about the article, something about the U.S. sending troops somewhere else to teach people about democracy, which was kind of funny, but it's, in a way, it's not, it's just reality. That we have had now in the United States, we've had two contested elections. By the way, I don't buy into the contesting by either. I'm not making some sort of argument that Gore really won or that Kerry really won or anything like that. But nonetheless, hotly contested elections, okay,
mm-hmm.
And close elections. And in fact, this last election is the first one in 16 years in which the winner actually won a majority of the popular vote. And yet, do not even see the irony in telling everybody else about voter fraud and about what can, you know, what a fair election consists of. It's mind-boggling.
Especially when you take into account, you know, not just telling them, but saying, yeah, we're going to send international inspectors to monitor your election for you and that kind of thing. And, you know, that drives me crazy, the idea of foreigners being allowed to come in and watch the counting of votes here. You know, I sure as hell don't want international election inspectors. I would rather have George Bush steal an election and take a third term than let a bunch of guys in baby blue helmets tell me that he lost.
Right.
And, yeah, in fact, from what I read, like, there were some people some international inspectors who did show up to try to observe elections here and apparently were booed right out of the room and weren't allowed to inspect anything. I hope that that's really the case.
Right. Well, but again, the fact of the matter is, the average Fox News viewer has absolutely no problem whatsoever just switching from, you know, screaming at these Guardian letter writers to saying, aha, well, look, we say that the election in Ukraine wasn't fair, thus it wasn't. And, you know, what these people know about Ukraine, either current circumstances, its history, any its culture, anything, could fit on the head of a pin with room to spare.
That's funny, man, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. I was doing some research for something I was going to write later, earlier today. And just, you know, part of the funny thing about being an empire is that it means that you're supposed to know everything about the rest of the world. Well, I'll get to this on the other side of the break.
Yeah, there we go. We're going out so they can hear the music. Good. All right, everybody. It's the week. No, it's not. It's the Peter Principle. We'll be right back with Matt Bargainier. Alright, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Principle. I'm Scott Horton filling in tonight for Peter, who will be back Monday. And if you're wondering who the heck is Scott, I am the host of the weekend interview show every Saturday on Republic from 3 to 5 p.m. And make sure and tune in tomorrow. I'm going to be talking with Gordon Prather all about Iran and that son of a biscuit eater, John Bolton, who I heard a rumor just got promoted in the U.S. State Department. So it's going to be a great show tomorrow. Make sure to tune in for that. And for right now, we're wrapping up an interview with Matt Bargainier. He's the editor of antiwar.com. And Matt, when we went out to break, we were talking about the irony of exporting democracy when we're not supposed to be a democracy in the first place, and we can't even hold an election right anyway.
Yeah, and the problems of empire, this is something that libertarians and conservatives especially should be able to see. Because it's essentially the same as the libertarian or conservative critique of the domestic bureaucracy. That is, for one thing, you have the Hayekian approach, which is that there are information problems inherent in any bureaucracy. And the more centralization that you have, the more information problems that you have. There's simply, you cannot have, for instance, you cannot have a command economy, a centralized command economy, because it does not give you the dispersed, decentralized information that comes in the market, right?
Right.
Well, if you're going to run an empire, it's just exactly the same thing, except on a much larger scale.
So this is how we end up with guys delivering trucks full of tainted fuel across a war zone with no armor?
Well, right, and this is how we end up with, you know, the apparently 23-year-old in charge of getting water to the entire country of Iraq that I just spoke of.
Right.
But in the case of Ukraine, just to look at, you know, so we know about everything. We know what's best for everybody, and we know enough about all of these countries to know in the first place, before we even get to the issue of what we should do, that we even know what's supposedly wrong, right? And so I was interested to know, to look up a few things, and I had just gotten started on it this evening, about how much Americans really know about Ukraine.
Do I really want to hear this?
Well, this is just a tiny little snippet. Again, I had just gotten started on this, but this is, I think that this is a telling thing. I was trying to figure out how many people in this country even speak Ukrainian. I mean, it seems to me that if you really want to get some sort of view of what's going on in a place and you really want to understand it, you have to at least have somebody that you trust translating. You know, if you can't read it yourself, you need to at least have somebody you trust, preferably multiple sources, translating what's going on there. Well, I was looking for, I looked on the Modern Language Association website, MLA.org, just to look and see if I could find any stats on, you know, how many colleges in this country offer Ukrainian as a course,
mm-hmm.
or how many people were enrolled in courses. And I'm not cherry-picking here. I just have 2 years, but there are only a few years that were available. So for 1995, there were 84 students enrolled in Ukrainian courses in all the colleges and universities in the United States.
Wow.
84. And that's only 13 graduate students, you know, people who you can really believe actually know something about the language.
So maybe letting them in the room with the National Security Council isn't necessarily good enough for formulating a Ukraine policy?
Yeah. I mean, this is just just for comparison's sake, there were 179 who were studying Samoan that year.
Wow.
In 2002, it's improved a bit, but in 2002, there were 126 students studying Ukrainian. That's it.
Well,
and
obviously,
the
it's
we
up
know
to us
about.
To decide who their next government's going to be.
Right, because we know everything about the Ukraine.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Matt. Everybody, read what Matt writes at antiwar.com. Thanks again for coming on the show, bro.
No problem. Thank you.